Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
TRE in the afternoon, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Men Talk. With me in the studio today is Bernard Evans, Russell Hood and Chris Arms. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Thank you all for coming in. We have an Englishman, an Irishman and a Scotsman today. Yay. We have a joke with us in the studio. Brilliant. If you're listening at home and you'd like to get involved, you can. Here's how.
To contact TRE, please call 952 78 4000. Email studio@tre.radio. Send us a WhatsApp on +34 645 99 67 95.
Okay, there's an article here talking about driverless taxis. You might have heard this in the news this week. Apparently, they're going to hit UK roads from next year. Transport Secretary confirmed the government was fast-tracking pilots of driverless taxis and bus-like services to spring 2026, a year earlier than planned. Does this excite you or terrify you?
Well, it terrifies me.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrifies me. I mean, the idea of getting into a car without somebody in control of it is just horrific.
I agree. Friends of mine were in LA recently, about a month ago, and they were filming themselves in the back of a taxi, and I thought, well, this is going to be a dull video. And then they turned it round to the non-driver, and they were all, oh, my God! And they were in a driverless taxi, and it was both exciting and terrifying. And I thought, oh, I'm not sure how I feel about that. I don't think I'd want to rush to be one of the first, that's for sure.
I think it's going to be different, very different to driverless taxis in LA, where the roads are so wide.
That's true.
To the roads in London, where the roads are hundreds of years old, and there are roadworks everywhere, and cyclists. And I mean, what could possibly go wrong? I guess it's a logical extension of it happening, but I think it'll be interesting to see how the trial goes and how many crashes there are. I think London's going to be a lot more complicated for them than they realise. It's very different to the streets of LA.
Yeah, definitely.
But is it where we're just putting the focus? Because I live beside a primary school in Dublin, and every day I see mums and dads in the car texting as they're driving away.
Oh, no.
So at least it will stop that. And how much do we go to that to analyse that as a statistic? We don't. We just tend to kind of think this stuff happens and we don't think about it. So it would stop that.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't text if you're not a human, if there's nobody there.
I think it'll be interesting to see how it pans out.
And exactly.
I think you can see the headlines now. There are going to be accidents caused by it.
And people going, see.
Yeah, it's going to happen. I mean, at some point, it'll just become the norm. But I think it's like everything. It's just going to take time to get going. They'll work their way through the issues. And then in 5 years' time, it'll just be, well, it's accepted. Now, how the black cab drivers will feel about it is a whole different ballgame.
Well, quite.
Yeah.
Because it's
potentially wrecking their livelihood even more.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Didn't even think about that.
I mean, I wonder what you'd do if there's any kind of malfunction. You know, if you're sitting in the front, I mean, at the same time, a driver, because something awful could happen to the driver and you'd need to take over if there was actually a human there. But if there wasn't and there's some kind of malfunction and it starts going in a different direction, could you kind of jump into the seat and take over, I wonder? Or at least grab the steering wheel? I don't know. That would be good to know beforehand.
Yeah, I mean, I find I get nervous getting into a right-hand drive car now and sitting in the passenger seat. And I'm like, no, this is wrong. This is just not right.
Yeah, I have that when family come from the UK. They go to get in the car and I go, you can drive if you want. Oh, I would notice, and they realised they'd actually tried to do it. They went to get in the passenger seat, was where they used to get in.
Yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
They go, no, it's all right, I'm not going to drive.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens. And
Yeah.
You're right, it will become normal, won't it? In however many years' time, we'll do it all the time and we'll have the conversation. Do you remember when there used to be drivers? do you remember when people would drive the taxis?
And I think you'll find this. Are they going to have one of those break this in case of emergency things in the front of a taxi?
Yeah, exactly.
So what do you do if there is an emergency?
Yeah.
You know, back to your comment about taking over the steering wheel. Is there going to be a set of instructions like that? I don't know. Yeah,
exactly.
And we said about logical extensions. Will it now start to move on to ambulances and things like that? That they turn up?
Oh, yeah.
And there's just a paramedic in the back seat treating you.
Oh, exactly.
So where do we draw the line?
Yeah.
Definitely. Oh, it's, I mean, you do get... This is probably a really stupid comment. We've had driverless trains for years, haven't we? Yeah, they've sorted it out so you don't... Some trains have drivers and some don't. So that's been happening for a long time. And when you get on a train, as far as I'm concerned, you have no idea whether there's a driver or not. And you just trust that everything's going to be fine, basically.
But in theory, there shouldn't be any other trains on the track. That's the danger about the road.
Yeah.
And it's what everybody else around it is doing.
Yeah.
That's the worry.
Absolutely.
And we were just talking about the quality of driving generally. And, you know, can you imagine driverless taxis out here?
I mean, maybe they'll be better than humans. I'm not being funny. The amount of times I get a taxi that's like, you know, driving aggressively undertaking or whatever, and you think, well, maybe we'll be in a better position. Yeah.
We were commenting earlier that you can tell the quality of the... You can tell the time of the year by the quality of the driving here.
Yes.
Because it's started on that slippery slope now.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely getting worse, isn't it?
Yeah.
I can't believe the traffic... It's only June, and even in May, I was saying about the traffic, and it's just totally going to get worse. You really, even now, need to give yourself extra time for going anywhere.
Yeah.
It's just suddenly got worse.
Yeah. Okay, another piece about robots and stuff. As I read deeper into the article, this isn't as scary and bizarre as it initially sounded. Robots used for surgery in the NHS will become commonplace to slash waiting lists and speed up operation recovery. Around 22,700 robot-assisted procedures were conducted between January and March last year by NHS England, but this is expected to rise to 500,000 a year by 2035. The machines, which cost between £500,000 and £1.5 million, are capable of movements more precise than the human hand. Patients report faster recovery times, shorter hospital stays, less pain and reduced scarring than with traditional surgery. I wonder if you know whether you're told or asked if you have a robot or a human performing surgery on you. Would it bother you either way? Is it something?
I don't think so.
No?
I mean, assuming you've been properly diagnosed in the first place, hopefully that is by an actual doctor.
Yeah, quite. Yes.
If you're comfortable with that and you elect to have surgery and they say, this is how we're going to do it, I think I would have faith in it.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
Suppose it's the idea that you wouldn't necessarily know until I saw the fact that over 22,000 robot-assisted procedures were already taking place. I'm assuming that people going for the operation wouldn't know that. I don't know either. When you normally meet the surgeon. I mean, I've only had surgery once, and I remember meeting the surgeon. Or is that just something that happens in Grey's Anatomy? I'm not sure. But you have a conversation with a human, and if they said, I'm sorry, we can't introduce you to the surgeon because it's a robot, I think a lot of people would be a bit freaked out by that.
But is it going to bring the prices up? Because I'm involved in animal rescue. We do a lot of trap, neuter, return, and it's very simple surgery, but €200 for the average one now, and certainly from a rescue point of view, which I'm involved in, it's all pretty simple stuff, and if it meant that we can drop the prices for any of us, I'm sure that will be the main concern. Also, again, are people likely to make as many mistakes as robots? I'd love to see the statistics.
Well, exactly. It says that the robots are capable of movements more precise than the human hand. It seems like they're a much better thing. But again, is it putting human surgeons out of work? You know, this is the constant question with AI and robots, the idea of them taking humans' jobs, isn't it?
I think the challenge with surgery is that, you know, if it's something procedural that the robot can do because it understands it, what's going to happen, though, if the robot gets in there and it finds something unexpected?
And
this is always the challenge with AI, is that where AI struggles is that if something's predictable and repeatable,
Yeah.
But the minute it's got to make a decision, it's got to have data, it's got to have historical data to make the decision on. Mm. So if it doesn't have enough historical data, it's going to get to a point and go, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And that's where the human in the middle, as it's called, it makes the difference, because the human in the middle has all of that. And over time, there probably will be less need for the human in the middle, but certainly, mm-hmm. even where you use AI today, the human in the middle is still really important. And I think you're still going to see the same thing in surgery.
Yeah, definitely. I guess that's why they're robot assisted as opposed to robots doing it completely. Yeah. And that's the hope, isn't it, with AI, that it remains a tool, an assistant for humans, as opposed to taking over.
Yeah.
That's what we don't
have. I know it's a little outside surgery, but there's a big thing on the internet now where the younger generation are actually using AI for counselling for issues they're going through.
Yes, that is interesting.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And again, my initial reaction is, how can what robots don't have is sympathy and empathy and all that kind of thing that you'd hope you'd get from a human therapist.
But as you were saying earlier, they have so much of the knowledge of prehistorical answers pre-programmed in them.
Right.
And the argument for it is that they're maybe private and intimate things that people are more inclined to admit to a non-human than they might do to somebody
online.
And there'd
be no prejudgment there, would there, which professionally you shouldn't get from a human therapist, but you can't guarantee that you're
or
not,
a doctor, but you're always thinking they're judging me. They're judging.
Yeah, exactly. You never know, do you? You never know what they've been. Mm. You know, a lot of therapists become therapists because they've been through some kind of trauma themselves.
True. That's
definitely
very true. Yeah.
So a robot won't have had that.
I think it comes back to though, how much is it going to know? Because you know, the beauty of the human brain is it's able to react and adapt and draw inferences. Mm. And an AI is only as good as the model. So if the model behind it doesn't have the data or hasn't got that experience, it's going to hit a... And models learn all the time, but they can't learn, however many... they can't learn every life experience of every human being.
No.
Of course not, yeah.
Then again, maybe a human can't either. Okay, this is talking about lots of different examples. We had this one on Women Talk last week, but I wanted to keep it for you guys. It's talking about all the little things that can happen, micro stresses they're called, but that can drive us slightly mad. So it's a general kind of chat about little things and whether they really get to you or whether you just go, oh, whatever, nothing I can do about it, never mind. Things like being stuck in traffic, people who walk slowly, Wi-Fi buffering when watching a show, losing the TV remote, misplacing your phone, all kinds of things like that. Do you feel that as you have got older that you're more tolerant of these kind of things or less tolerant?
I think I've become more tolerant.
Yeah, oh, that's good.
I do find, like, in traffic again, in heavy situations, I think, well, what the heck? I'm stuck here. There's no point fretting about it.
Yeah.
And there's people leaning on their horns. I'm more annoyed about them than I am the traffic jam.
Yeah.
You're not going to get anywhere any quicker. Get off your horn, you know, and just listen, read your phone or something, to pass the time.
Yeah.
But there are the little niggles, the walking slowly thing. Oh, God. And if anybody on the London Underground stood on the wrong side of the escalator, when that's the walking side...
Oh, hell to pay.
Oh, the temptation to push.
Overwhelming. Target-rich environment.
Yes.
I think, we were talking earlier about the state of the traffic, right? I mean, there is a degree of frustration about the fact is that, people do seem to forget how to drive sometimes. That's still kind of, you look at them and go, how did you actually ever pass your driving test?
Absolutely.
But the London Underground was an interesting one. I think you get, as you get older, you get more tolerant to some things and less tolerant to other things.
Oh, yes.
it depends on what you are. But yeah, I mean, some things it's like, you know, my kids get worried about it and it's like, yeah, you know, can't be bothered about that. But some things I get annoyed about, they go, why? So I think part of it's generational and part of it's age. I think as you go through life, some things bother you less and some things bother you more.
The thing with traffic, if I'm not in a rush, then it doesn't bother me. And I kind of go, oh, whatever, this is annoying, but there's nothing I can do about it. And I've got the radio on or a podcast or some great music and I'm just chilling and it doesn't really matter. But if I've got to get to work or I've got to get to an appointment or I've got to go and get to the theatre or something where you feel you genuinely can't be late, then it starts to... I know there's nothing you can do about it, but I'm like, come on! I find it very difficult to just go, oh, never mind, because I'm sitting there thinking, well, this does matter. I can't be late. And so I struggle a little bit when I feel like it matters.
Isn't that a bit of planning ahead should take a little bit more of that into account?
Well, definitely. That's what I mean. When you know, there's so much traffic, we have to leave earlier. I'm definitely not a late person or a last minute person. I definitely am a planner, and lateness does kind of annoy me. So if that happens, it's definitely never any fault of my own. Which is why it's irritating, because it's other people's fault.
Well, isn't it really about the small little nuances of life and whether we can't deal with them? And for me, what you were saying earlier, the people who stop in the street to read in a text and you crash into them.
Yes.
And you kind of think, so you're talking about driving. This happens in pedestrian stuff as well.
Yeah.
Or I know it doesn't so much happen today, but you'd be in a queue and somebody be trying to take a cash queue to get money out of a machine, somebody be trying to take out 20 and the message would come up, we only have 50 euro denomination notes or whatever, and they go back and they put enter in 20 again, and at what point do you go on to go up and enter in the conversation and do it? And while I'm on a roll, when I was leaving here to come last week, I spilt water on the kettle, tripped out the entire apartment while the washing machine was on.
Oh gosh.
And four clocks just started flushing 0000, and I couldn't deal with it.
So you went to the pub.
It literally made me late for the airport. I'm not kidding, but I said I couldn't be in Spain for a week and think about them flashing on four zeros for a week.
Oh gosh, yes, very annoying.
So less patience, well done lads, but less patience as I get older, let me show you.
Yes, I patience has definitely always been something I've felt the need to work on. And as I say, if I'm in a situation that I can say to myself, you know what, it doesn't really matter, then I'm all right. But too much matters, I feel. Well, you know, waiting too long in a restaurant, I'll just get up and go somewhere else. Like that annoys me.
Oh, bad service.
Does. Yeah.
Bad service generally.
It really.
But there is another side to that as well. And I do try and practice this a little bit, because somebody could be interacting with you in a restaurant, a bar, a shop, and they could come across as really rude, but you don't know what day they've had.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, so if you just chuck that question into your own head before you bite their head off, you know, and to say, you never know, they could just have had a really bad phone call.
Absolutely.
There may just be a miserable git.
Yeah, that's true too.
You know, but there is a possibility that something has impacted them.
Yeah.
And so...
What a lovely person you are.
I try. I'm working at it.
But it's absolutely true. You know, something could happen to someone in the morning and then they go to work and they take that attitude with them and pass, you know, that's why trying to be a good person and smile at people, because the same thing happens with positivity. If you go into a shop and you smile and you say, oh, you're having a nice day and
absolutely,
thank you so much, lovely to see you, they think, oh, that's nice, and they'll pass it on to the next person. But if you're rude and angry, they're likely to be rude and angry to the next person, and so it goes on.
It's
not always easy, but it's a nice thing to remind ourselves of.
But if you've ever had to deal with bureaucracy, as I'm sure we all have, one of the best ways to get around it and actually keep somebody on the line is actually just to be so pleasant to them.
Yeah.
Kill them with kindness, because they're not used to it.
Mm.
So people are usually shouting and screaming and all of this. So you're really nice, this poor bureaucrat that gets all of this abuse at the end of the line. They're going to do everything they can to help you.
Yeah.
And I swear it works every time.
Oh.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think is that, you know, people that typically are in that position, what the best, the general way to get the best customer service out of people is, if the people are in a service industry, is to be nice to them.
Absolutely.
Because they're used to the opposite.
Yeah.
And it makes it harder to refuse what, on the face of it, could be slightly unreasonable or slightly asking them to go above and beyond.
Yeah.
So if you can do that, then yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, it's good to remind ourselves of these things regularly.
Yes.
I need to remind myself a few times a day. We better take a break.
Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Men Talk. With me in the studio today is Bernard Evans, Russell Hood and Chris Arms. There's an article I found earlier that reads, a woman has revealed why she chose to ditch her comfortable home to live in a caravan in a holiday park. 31-year-old Katrina, who lives in the south of England, decided to uproot her life in her £1,000 per month flat in March this year and move into a two-bedroom caravan. She purchased her mint-condition caravan outright for £26,000 and has a guaranteed pitch in a holiday park for 9 years, paying ground rent quarterly. She said it's the best thing she's ever done. She's now paying half of what she was before, and now her disposable income has doubled. She now pays £3,500 a year for her ground rent, which includes her pitch, access to a swimming pool, sauna and hot tub. The fee also covers water, waste and rubbish. I just wondered if it's something that you would consider, whether you get the attraction, whether it makes a lot of sense, or not in a million years would you do that? Anyone?
Not in a million years, I don't think.
No, really?
It depends where you're coming from, because I did ask this to Hannah earlier, but if you don't mind me, I'll throw the thing at you. Very quick reaction. What do you think a two-bedroom rental would be in Dublin? Quick.
£2,000 a month?
2.7 and going up.
Oh my.
So, yeah. You know, three quarters of people's rent are going on, or wages are going on rent now in Dublin. It's crazy. Mm. I know things are a little bit more stable and cooler in the UK, but it's going up. So I've had one friend and colleague, and he couldn't deal with it, and he actually just left early, quit and went over to Thailand, but he was also looking at doing stuff here. So what you're talking about is not just happening there. I've know people are doing it, or they're moving in with their parents into a little thing in the back garden.
Well, we're seeing it a bit here, aren't we? People being priced out, the Spanish people being priced out because of tourists. It's a massive problem.
There's the big protests, and the Spanish government talk about doubling the purchase costs for non-EU citizens and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's a it's definitely a problem. And you saw in the Rachel Reeves' statement yesterday, she talked about building social, however much she was going to spend on social housing over the next 10 years in the UK. Mm. It was a huge, more money than the UK spent in many, many years on that. So, yeah, it's definitely a problem. And I guess, I think there's an awful lot of people that moved to this part of the world would say that's part of the reason they moved, not just for the weather, but the fact is that you get a lot more house for your money.
Well, yeah, very definitely. And certainly, I mean, back to the original thing about the caravan, the idea would fill me with horror, personally. But as a concept, I think it's perfectly valid. Mm. Yes, it's not the sort of thing I would like, but I'm not very sociable. And I don't particularly want to be in that close proximity to people that are on holiday the whole time, because we all know what that's like here.
Yeah.
But as a way of saving money and being much more cost effective, it makes complete sense.
It does, doesn't it?
If it suits your personality type.
Yeah. I remember thinking years ago, not seriously considering it, but talking to people about living on a boat or on a barge and all the different opportunities that you have that way and how that can be much cheaper. Way of life, and there was a part of me that thought, oh, that sounds really fun, I'd quite like that, but then the reality of it all, maybe not. And I think the same with the caravan. There's a part of, and I am really sociable, so there's a part of me that thinks, oh, that would be really fun, but
I'd be curious to see it, because again, it's something I've looked into quite a bit. And I know when we say caravan, if I can throw in the Irish reference to Father Ted, you're thinking of the two lads up Irish dancing in that little caravan. Well, I think perhaps the movement they're talking about is a thing called the tiny homes movement. And again, for what we're going through in Ireland at the moment, these things have really sprung up. So it's well worth a look up tiny homes. But these things are quite luxurious. They're bigger than most houses, and if you search around, you'll find they're actually palatial and they're coming
Why
in.
Why are they called tiny then?
That was the initial concept for them. It started in Canada, and that's where it moved out from, and it spread around the world, and it's called the tiny homes movement. But if you do look it up, you'll see that and you can get them in caravans, you can get them in flat pack houses, and they open up, and the term caravan is above them, but you can be in a situation, and I know like plenty of young people and indeed mature people who are looking at a little bit of land, and you kind of think, well, do I buy a 2-bed house in the capital that may come in at, you know, 280,000 or do I get this flat pack on a piece of land and live in there and spend the money on all the things?
I think that sounds great. I'm gonna look up the tiny home movement next week, definitely. Okay, we better get another break in.
Hannah Murray, TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Men Talk. With me in the studio today is Bernard Evans, Russell Hood and Chris Arms. Apparently, men are better at saving for a rainy day than women. Funds that men will typically have £1,300 more than their female counterparts stashed away. So you don't need to go into personal financial situations or whatever, but how do you feel you have been throughout your life as a saver? Have you always been a saver? Has it been installed in you from when you were young? Have you never done it? Have you got better as you got older? Etc., etc.
Definitely got better as we've got older. We've probably got more. We have absolutely got way more savings now. I mean, you know, when we started out as a couple, I mean, first of all, you know, we earned a lot less, and house prices, you know, we had a house in the south of England, so even then they weren't cheap. So that ate way more of our income. And then we had children, so that basically, you know, they say it costs $250,000 to bring up a child. Yeah, probably.
Oh my God.
So,
cats are cheaper.
Dogs are. Absolutely. Yes, dogs are definitely cheaper, although I question that sometimes. And then you get to the point where, you know, both kids are old enough and then the kids leave home, and then you actually find that you have all this disposable income, and then you can actually start saving. So I think it's also part of a stage of life thing as well.
Well, I've definitely improved with age, that's for sure. I mean,
I'm not sure how convinced I am, Russell.
Well, I was in London in the 80s and 90s,
yeah.
And in that kind of stupid, sort of yuppie-type world, you know, it was, you fell out of the office, well, you walked out of the office, you fell out of the wine bar,
yeah.
You jumped in a taxi, you know, that kind of life, and all the party stuff that went with that, and it was a wonderful time, but I was shattered by the end of it. It's why I moved to Spain. You know, I couldn't stand being in the city anymore. Longer. I think you become more sensible as you get older. I wish I had been a lot more sensible when I was younger, but I had a damn good time.
Yeah, so. Nice. So it's hard to regret it because you look back with fond memories.
Well, I can't change it, so what's the point?
No, absolutely.
I think it's true. You get more sensible as you get older, and you do kind of, to your point, you know, you live life more when you're younger.
Yeah. Or you live a different kind of life. How about that?
Yeah.
Yes, you know, I think we've had this conversation before. I mean, it's like going out after work 5 nights a week, falling out the wine bar five nights a week,
yeah.
And then turning up. And then I think we've had this conversation before about turning up to work the following morning with the hangover, Hannah.
Difficult, always a challenge.
Yes.
it's hard to kind. I always find it difficult to work out where I'd rather spend my money. You know what I mean? What am I saving for? And the answer normally is a holiday, as opposed to the future. So I normally am saving, but it's for something, and then I'll spend it and start saving again. So I feel like there's a kind of circle of saving, spending, saving, as opposed to properly saving for 20, 30 years' time kind of thing.
But Hannah, if you're saying that the thing is that men are better than women, and I'm going to kind of throw myself on the hand grenade here, but I would actually, my experience would be, and I deal with a lot of college-related students or whatever, I think it's the girls are better. I just see them a little bit more smarter and tuned in. But I do think it may defer back to what you were saying about the guys. The guys are dressing to impress and taxis to impress and all of the rest. So I think there's... two different goals in mind. So I don't know. I think the girls are probably smarter in that way, and I see them squirreling about. I'm aware, like I lecture in a college in Dublin, and I would generally see the girls are the ones who are tuned in to getting them starting the mortgage preparations. And,
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They probably wouldn't disagree with that, and although I knew some pretty wild women in London.
I mean, I've had friends in the past that I remember that never, ever, ever went out, never did anything socially, never went out for dinner, and were just constantly had in their head. And this was pre-COVID years ago. And I remember having a conversation with her, and she said to me, "Oh, Hannah, you're always out having a good time." And I'm like, "Well, you know, I only live once," kind of thing. And I said, "You don't seem to go out much. Can I ask you why?" Because I was always interested that she never seemed to do anything. She said, "Well, I was brought up to always have at least 4 months' wages in the bank." And I was like, "God, really? Is that how other people live? Is that normal, or is that just you?" So I was thinking, "God, that's certainly not the case with me." And she said, "No, I don't know. That's just how I was brought up." So, yeah, I think I'm constantly thinking of my future. And she would have been in her late 20s when we were having this discussion. Constantly thinking of my future when I retire. I want to make sure I have enough money for then. So she, you know, wasn't living a fun life because she was thinking about 50, 60 years' time. Yeah. And there was a small part of me that thought, how sensible. But the rest of me thought, how dull. You're not living your life.
You can still save for a pension anyway, so.
Yeah, exactly, without not having a life.
I think it's somewhere in the middle is a good balance.
Try and have a balanced life.
Yeah.
In all aspects, one might say. We better take the last ad break and then we can relax.
Hannah Murray. TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the last part of today's Men Talk. With me in the studio today, Bernard Evans, Russell Hood and Chris Arms. Now, this is a kind of weird one. The article reads, "Playing snog, marry, avoid with colleagues at work could be sexual harassment, a tribunal has ruled. The crass and inappropriate game may breach the Equality Act." If you haven't heard of the game, it involves naming three people, then asking a person who of the trio they would like to kiss, marry and steer clear of altogether. It's a fun, silly little game. And I think defining sexual harassment is a very tricky thing to do these days, but I sort of agree that it's not really something one should play at work, unless you're like mates with everyone you work with, which can happen, of course.
I think part of it is kind of what we were talking about earlier, is this would have probably been far more culturally acceptable 30 years ago.
Right, yeah.
I mean, back to the conversations we were having about, you know, the London in the 90s. What was culturally acceptable then is not culturally acceptable now. And you have to understand that... and you see that all the time, right? You see it all over the news. You see things happening. And I think that's part of it as well, is that people's expectations of sexual harassment, people's expectations of all of that has changed. Mm. And looking back at some of the things that went on in the 80s and 90s, you go, really? But you're looking at that with a lens from where we are now in. So I think things have very much changed. And I think that drives, you look at these things now, we look at these things with a different, because I think somebody said that in work office in the 80s and 90s, probably wouldn't have got a reaction you expected.
I think with all of these things, it's about knowing your audience.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and there might be people that you work with who you're really matey with and you have a bit of banter with and you could have these kind of jokes with and it will be totally fine because you're basically mates. I mean, you might even go out socially together, so you literally are mates. And then there'll be other people you work with that you wouldn't in a million years have those kind of conversations with because they're your colleagues and you respect each other as colleagues, and it's just a sort of an inappropriate conversation to have. So I think it's just understanding who you're talking to.
But where are they driving us? I mean, we're talking about AI earlier. Are they dehumanising us that we won't even be able to pass these comments from anymore? And yes, in 20 years' time, people will be judging us, and in another 20 years' time, it'll come back. And what do we do? Do we just put a chip in and switch ourselves off? And absolutely anything can be used as bullying, as asking somebody for a pen or a sexual comment. It can all be interpreted that way. So, like, you know, it'd be almost shorter to give us a list of the things that we can do these days.
Yeah, absolutely.
But maybe there is the nuance, because having looked at the article as well, it almost implied that you couldn't do it about celebrities. And, like, what's wrong with that? And then some of the thing that came up in the article was suggesting that maybe if the celebrities was of a particular race or colour or gender or haircut, so that was the reason that we couldn't say whether it's... I'm sorry, I have a type. Where are the handcuffs? Line me up. Like,
so you're being racist if the one that you say avoid is... Oh, goodness, okay.
But then the problem as well is, where's the victim of this? If this is sexual harassment, who is being victimised by it? Because if this is, as you say, banter, because I can't imagine that it's the sort of thing that would happen with an office full of people saying, well, and you're the one I would avoid.
Yeah, exactly. That would be awful doing it.
That would be terrible. Yeah. So... if it's a bit of banter between people, yes, it's a bit questionable, but where is the victim? Mm. Where is the true harm?
Yeah. I think it's a very sad situation when people, particularly men, are nervous about complimenting a woman because of how it could be taken. I think that's a real shame. But I also think it goes back to knowing your audience and knowing who you're speaking to, the relationship that you have with that person. Have you ever discussed, you know, the way people look or fashion or things like that with that person before? Or do you purely only ever talk business? If you only ever talk business and suddenly say, oh, your hair looks gorgeous, oh, I love that blouse on you, they might think, was he commenting on the way I look? But if you have a good relationship with someone, not necessarily friends, just a good working relationship, and a man says, oh, I love your dress, or oh, your hair looks nice today, most women should say, oh, thank you very much, that's very kind of you, and it's a nice exchange between two pleasant human beings.
I think the problem with things like sexual harassment is that it's all about how the person on the end perceives it.
Exactly.
And that's the challenge, is that you can never put yourself in that person's shoes. Mm. So you can say something that to 9 other people in the room can be completely innocuous, but there'll be one person who takes that, not the way you intended it, not the way the 9 other people took it. And that's the challenge with all of this, is
definitely.
That, and you look at that, is that, okay, there are clearly some people who do mean things as sexual harassment, but a lot of them are, it's about how the person in the room perceives it, and that's the challenge. But again, that's back to knowing your audience. But
exactly.
But again, you can't, if you're not comfortable with the audience, then don't say something.
Yeah, if you're not sure how it's going to be taken, then maybe it's better not to.
But again, that's where we're into this situation where you're picking up something from one of the big chain shops who are advertising things, and they can't even show a woman using iron because people will explode. So likewise with a Hoover, it's all turned around and it's all U-turned. And again, at what point are we going to draw the line, and at what point are we going to say we're all a bit normal and this does count as office banter or whatever? We've got to allow some human qualities to us, otherwise the off button.
Well, I remember we had a situation, and again it was back in London, and HR sent out this diktat that said in all of the branches swearing was to be banished. Well,
let's that went just down
say,
well.
Let's just say the air was blue when we saw it. And it was, and the office was very mixed. And so we took a vote on it, and we said, are we going to banish it? And they said, if no. And that was it. So we just ignored what HR had to say, because that was part of our stress relief, you know, and sort of like, oh, expletive, and then, you know, you got on with all the other stuff you had to do.
I suppose the challenging thing with that is there could be one person in the office that doesn't like swearing and is offended by swearing, and that's the issue we seem to be having today. It only takes that one person, as you say. If you're saying, oh, you look nice today, there could be that one that says, he shouldn't be commenting on the way I look, he's my colleague, and then it kind of ruins it for everyone else that wants to swear and wants to be complimentary.
And I bet in most cases it's not that they're upset and the snog marry avoid, they're probably the people who always get avoid.
Oh, you've absolutely hit the nail
on the head there, yes. It's the why am I the avoidable one? But also, I think, to your comment about the swearing, in some industries, that kind of happens, that's kind of part of the culture.
Yeah.
In some industries, it's unacceptable. So, again, not to know your audience. If that's a way of accepting in the industry, then that's fine. But if it's if it's not, if it's, you know, if it's not expected in conference calls in your industry, then that's fine.
Yeah,
but if
absolutely.
It's just an accepted thing, but yeah, it's, you know, in 20 years' time, what I'd love to walk forward 20 years' time and see how people judge things that went on today, because things that we all think are acceptable today will probably be deemed totally unacceptable.
I bet you what one of them will be, you won't be able to say snog, marry, or void, because marry will be a religious connotation or something, so it'll be snog, cohabitate, or avoid, or something. Make sure nobody's offended.
Or gentle pet. Snog's too explicit, yes. Oh, it is scary, isn't it, though? I mean, it is a worry to think that we're going to get more and more woke and things are going to get harder. You know, I've interviewed so many comedians who say in the last 20 years it's really difficult. Being a comedian is more and more... I mean, some of them don't care and are like, this is me, yeah, if you don't like it, whatever, which is, I think, the best attitude to have in comedy. But some of them are really nervous because people are taking offence and complaining, and it's like, oh, God, must be so hard.
But there is pushback on that now. Some of the comedians are coming together, and Jerry Seinfeld, wouldn't be a big fan of him, but he's pushed a lot of the pushback thing, and some of them are getting on stage now. And so if you search for it online, you'll find them.
Yeah.
And that this is where we need to be, blowing in that wind.
There's a balance in all of it, right?
Yeah.
You look back now, and as I say, some things that were done probably with hindsight genuinely are unacceptable. But some things you look at and go, the pendulum swung too far the other way.
Mm.
And you've got to find the reason. There's a reasonable balance somewhere in the middle of all of this.
Yeah.
Well, I always thought that... I mean, there are certain comedians I just always found totally offensive, and they're generally known, so I won't bother naming them. But... They made their careers on racism and sexism. But then there's genuine satire, which British comedy is brilliant about. And, of course, satire is generally you're saying the exact opposite of what you mean, but everybody gets it.
Yeah.
There seems to be a lack of appreciation for satire now because it's the younger generation that haven't really been brought up with it. They haven't been exposed to that.
Mm. So they just find it offensive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's it. So it's lost... the satirical edge, which is what made it funny. It's what made Private Eye great reading because, you know, it skewered everything.
Yeah.
You know, so you can say a lot of things are questionable. And there's a Brazilian comedian, I can't remember his name, but he's just facing jail for exactly this reason, for making offensive remarks. But when you read what he's actually said... it's satire.
Oh, gosh.
You know, I mean, it's very close to the knuckle satire, but it's still satirical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, I mean, if I can get the Irish reference in again, Father Ted, I mean, and Graham Lenehan has been,
brilliant.
You know, on about this. Like, Channel 4 in the UK are now issuing warnings before certain episodes. Now, at what point in the 90s, when I was watching that, did I realise I was a racist or something?
But it's not just Father Ted. That? There are so many things now where you remember watching them 10 years ago, and you see, you know, the one I find one of the most ludicrous is...
30 seconds.
This report may contain flashing images. I mean, come on. It's a news programme and there are depressed journalists.
If it was images of flashing, I'd understand. But
epilepsy, that's the problem.
Yeah, it's to do with epilepsy.
It is.
That's exactly why it is. That's a health issue.
Yeah, that's genuine. Yeah.
Sorry, thank you guys very much for the end of the show. Sorry, Chris. Howard Brereton is next. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.